Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Ooh, best last line of a movie ever.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about movies from Letterboxd, the social network for film lovers. Each episode, your host Slim, that's me, and Gemma are joined by a Letterboxd friend for a chat about their four favorite films. That is, the four films you choose as your favorites on your Letterboxd profile. As you listen along, we have links in the episode notes to the movies, lists, and people we talk about. So there's no excuse not to add these films to your watch lists. Today, our guest is writer, director, New Yorker, Letterboxd member, and rom-com prince, Jonah Feingold.
Oh my God, what an introduction.
Oh yeah.
I'm like starstruck, by the way. Like I said, this is one of my favorite podcasts. This is a true honor.
Unreal.
Shut up. We got that on the record. We'll pay you later. Hey, the intro is not over yet. It gets better. Jonah's Letterboxd handle is his name, Jonah Feingold, and his four favorites are Steven Spielberg's Hook, Rob Reiner's When Harry Met Sally, written by Nora Ephron, the original animated The Lion King with music by Elton John and Hans Zimmer, and the very first Pirates of the Caribbean film, directed by Gore Verbinski. We are talking to Jonah this week because his own feature debut, Dating and New York, is landing in theatres, and I am curious to know how, according to Jonah's Letterboxd list entitled Dating and New York Inspo, Jurassic Park became an influence on this very modern rom-com. Explain yourself.
You know, I'll jump right into it. It was a movie I was watching quite a bit during the pre-production of our film because I love the way that score is used in that movie, particularly sentimental cues, the scene where Hammond is explaining his passion for the park and the ice cream is melting, and with Laura Dern, and it's that very sort of like heartfelt scene at the empty table. And I just thought, we have a scene in the movie where Jabuki's character, jumping slightly ahead, is looking in the mirror, and our temp music was the music from Jurassic Park in that scene. And
as you do
with a rom-com. And I also want to just highlight some of the blocking techniques and the use of light and the use of just playing with subverting genre and expectation. Jurassic Park has taken more of a horror movie approach these days, but that original first one is such a family film, you know, and it's about fatherhood and parenthood and all these other themes, you know, what a new form of family. And I just kept watching. It was like my comfort movie. And I think subconsciously that was why it was there. Also, what I'll say is there's a deleted scene in Dating in New York where Wendy, one of our main characters, talks about how obsessed she is with Jurassic Park. And that ultimately got cut, but it was in the movie.
Aww.
So anyone on the fence that is like a Jurassic Park fan, their eyebrows are now going up like, oh, okay, maybe it's time to go to the theater, check this movie out. If that's the case, I'm down.
I've talked about this before on the pod. I was on the fence for a long time, I think, because at the time that Jurassic Park came out, I was more into the more intellectual Spielbergs. And I just thought, dinosaurs, boys movie. And then I watched it for the first time in lockdown last year and went, why did nobody tell me that it was a feminist science film? I would have been there on day one.
You know, I wrote one of my thesis papers in film school about that movie and about how it was a sort of cross intersection of like Phil Tippett's puppetry work mixed in with ILM, and how the movie sort of transcends itself because, just to sound as pretentious as possible in the first 5 minutes here, it transcends itself because it is, I believe Jurassic Park is a metaphor for the changing blockbuster film industry, wherein you literally had, you said bye to puppets and hello to VFX. And quite literally in the film, you were saying good, you know, hello to this new cloning technology as a way to introduce new spectacle to the very people in the world of the movie. And it sort of like just levels up the whole point of the film in a sense. It's like a metaphor for Hollywood saying hello to VFX, goodbye to the old ways, bringing things to life in like a non-organic way. I mean, Spielberg was Hammond in a sense,
right?
With, you know, and ILM working hand in hand. So Oh, we can get all on Jurassic Park.
Can we get that added to the Letterbox list? Can we get that thesis posted in the comments? We can all peruse it.
Oh, God. I don't want to undercut your intellectualism, but all I'm thinking about is Jeff Goldblum with his shirt unbuttoned, lying on that table, injured.
What's that thing? He like purrs. He's like, purr. He's like, all right. Like that GIF or that YouTube clip. He's just
Don't even. Oh, my God.
We will come back to Dating in New York soon, but we have to get started with the main course for now, which is the four faves that you have on Letterboxd. And your bio reads currently, a writer and director with a passion for romantic comedies and the film Hook. So let's get into it. Robin Williams, this is 1991. What if Peter Pan grew up? Where does your relationship with Hook begin?
My relationship with Hook begins on a summer night in my basement. And my parents decide, I think I'm like 3 or 4, and my parents decide that it's time for me to see this movie. And I watch it on a VHS tape, and it's on this, you know, small little TV screen. And literally, as if some sort of weird time multiverse, I just kept watching it day after day. Just kept watching it. I was engulfed in this film. Something just struck a chord. I said to my parents, I need to do this, whatever that was, and it turned out to be filmmaking. And I dressed up as Captain Hook. This is where it gets a little weird. I dressed up as Captain Hook to school up until about second grade. This is real, by the way. My parents get a call from my teacher saying, your son needs to stop coming in with a plastic hook around his hand. And we can laugh about this now, but I would start to eat food like Smee would eat at the, you know, buffet scene. I would double tap, you know, the floor to try to get a carpet to come down a flight of stairs in the way that Hook is introduced into the film. And it just immediately changed my life. It was my inciting moment in terms of the filmmaking as a career.
So would you say it's the film that made you want to become a filmmaker?
Absolutely. It's the film that made me want to become a filmmaker, storyteller, probably also has affected the way I sort of view life in terms of like keeping a childlike sense of wonder amidst what could be eventually growing up. I think we all do need to grow up, but that doesn't mean you need to lose that ability to sort of see the world, you know, and be awestruck by it and be curious and don't forget how to fly, you know, whatever that might be.
I love that you were cosplaying at such a young age, and my parenting philosophy, apart from that I always try to seek delight and joy in everything, is if you haven't put a costume on in front of your kid lately, you need to go and rectify that.
Wow. I like the use of cosplaying too. That's exactly what it was. It was normal. It was cool. I was just going to Comic-Con.
You were cosplaying
like
before anyone else was back then.
Yeah.
I rewatched this this week, and this feels like a crazy movie for 1991. You know, this feels like a modern take. Like, what if, like literally the tagline is, what if Peter Pan grew up? That feels like, you know, a pseudo A24 or big budget movie that would come out now. And people are like, oh my God, yeah, what a great idea. Yeah. Have you watched it recently, Jonah, over the years?
Yeah, you know, I have a very interesting history with this film, particularly in that I've seen it countless times. I know every single line. I know every single music cue. I know all the fun facts. And I've prepared all these for today's discussion in case some listeners don't. I also made a fan film loosely based off of the character Rufio. I met
Bangarang,
Dante Basker.
Right?
Bangarang.
Oh
yeah,
my God.
It was a whole Kickstarter. And I have thoughts about that, the way that came out, but I it was a dream come true. And, you know, to your point, the premise of the movie came from James V. Hart's son, Jake Hart. They were literally at dinner. And I think the kid said at the table, what if Peter Pan grew up? And then James Hart was like, that's the story. And then they wrote it. And of course, Nick Castle was supposed to direct it. Then Spielberg came in. It's funny, you know, it sounds like such an absurd, it's kind of like a log line, but it literally came from a kid saying that. And shout out to Jake and Jim, who are now friends. But you know, to my knowledge, that's where it came from.
Okay. Jeez. So before you unveil some of your Hook facts, I'm going to unveil some of ours.
I'm really excited.
I have to say that this is a first for us on this show, and that this is a film that appears in no significant stats for Spielberg or for any of the actors. It's not in like the top 10 Spielberg movies. It's not in the top 10 Robin Williams movies. It's just, It just doesn't show up anywhere. Where it does show up is on some really fantastic letterbox lists, one called Kicked in the Balls, A Cinematic History of Testicular Trauma. Say no more. One where, one of my faves, movies where a character says, Jack, in an emotional way.
I bet Pirates is on there too.
Yeah, of which there are many. And then the Jupiter Ascending stigma. Have you heard about this?
No, what's that?
It's a cinematic event whereas the audience desperately asks for innovative or simply more creative and bolder movies under the statement that Hollywood is running out of ideas. But when movies such as these do come out, they're bashed by critics and or audiences that criticize them based on precisely the reasons that they stand out and often for doing exactly what they're setting out to do, i.e. that movie is too corny, it has too much comedy, that remake does this thing that's different from the original, and so on. It is a genius list, which of course has Jupiter Ascending at the top, but Hook's on there, Resident Evil's on there, Halloween 3's on there, Signs is on there.
Brilliant.
Gosh. Absolutely brilliant.
The one note that I had too, I might have put this in my review, but Julia Roberts' wig in this movie. What an unreal statement that the costume designer made with that wig. What do you think, Jenna?
I think it's a movie that it's perfect for backlight. You know, I think Spielberg is obviously a big backlight guy. And so a big wig like that, which by the way, might be a theme in today's discussion. I think When Harry Met Sally has some wonderful backlight sort of frizzy hair work going on as well. But I think, well, the Julia Roberts of it all, I mean, that's, you know, the dynamic of this set, some of the stories you sort of hear through the myth of Hook, it's almost as interesting as the movie itself in terms of some of the behind the scenes that happen on this film. And, you know, there's fun facts, if it perhaps now is appropriate that I can drop
Let
some
us of in.
Drop them.
So, you know, let's start with, there's obviously Glenn Close is in this movie.
Oh my God.
Boo Box. Right. I mean, iconic Boo Box moment.
Did you spot that, Slim?
I was watching it and I was like, who is this actor as this character? And I must have forgotten to Google it, but I knew something was going on with that character.
Say it.
I did.
Yes, you made a boo-boo.
I did.
The Boo Box.
No,
Boo. The Boo Box.
No!
So for those who don't know, Glenn Close plays the pirate that you're watching and going, is that a drag pirate? Is that just a pirate with weird hair? Who is that pirate? That pirate is Glenn Close. And then you were about to say Phil Collins, weren't you? Which is my favorite cameo in this.
Oh my God, how amazing. Phil Collins plays the detective who comes and is sort of perhaps going to help investigate the missing of Robin Williams' kids, which feels like a spinoff ready to be made.
Oh,
I'm watching that.
Knives Out 20, 30 years earlier at that point.
correct. So you have those sort of fun casting moments like that. You know, you have the fact that Spielberg takes over directing this movie, that Michael Jackson was going to play the lead role, that it was going to be a musical, of which I think the blocking and the sequencing of these scenes does feel very inherently musical. And I was listening to the episode, I believe you guys had with Josh Rubin, who I sought advice from 5 years ago, emailed him, and you know, he's kind enough to get coffee with me. And I was like, tell me what it's like to be a director in comedy. And it's been amazing to see his career just skyrocket. And you guys were talking about the blocking in Jaws. Mm. And I think that this is like Jaws 2.0 level blocking where, you know, if Jaws was a result of having not enough money and not enough shooting days and therefore having to cover your scenes in Warners, Hook is an example of having too much money and too much excess in sort of production design that it's this grand sort of theatrical experience, which is part of the reason I love it. But yeah, there's one story that I don't know if it's made its way into the zeitgeist that I was lucky enough to hear from Dante Basco, who played the role of Rufio. Oh. And this is about how he got cast in the role. Are you guys familiar with the story?
No.
Okay, so you know Rufio, everyone listening, he's the...
rest in peace.
Rest in peace. Spoiler alert. Can you handle the truth? And so Dante and I are friends and I'm just in awe. You know, he's such a kind person. He's such an amazing actor. And he's telling me the story of how he got cast in the role and they were trying to figure out who to cast as Rufio and they could not find the character. Spielberg couldn't find it. Every single kid in Hollywood was auditioning for this role. And Dante comes in and does his bit and does the lines. And instantly Spielberg, you know, at the end of it goes, classic, like you got the part, kid. And amazing, so fun. cut to on set months later, and Dante's like rapping, and he's like, Steven, like, what was it? You know, I heard how many people you auditioned. Why me? And Spielberg goes, you were the only person that came in and just scared the shit out of me. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it just was like the bully. He was like, this guy would have scared me on the playground. And yet there was an element of still like a lot of like pathos. There was a lot of like emotion behind it. And so I love that story because that's the Rufio character, scary, but sensitive on the inside, just looking for a father figure.
Oh my God. One of my favorite Letterboxd reviews, actually, it's a one-liner from Anna Swanson is, hey, does anyone know if a divorced middle-aged man made this movie?
How did the rewatch for you, you know, when was the last time you guys had seen it, and did it feel nostalgic or magical, or was it more, was it outdated?
I actually was shocked to see this on 4K on Amazon Prime streaming. I was like, holy cow, it's about to get real right now when I fired this thing up. I love the intro to this movie. I feel like the magic is still there. You know, seeing him as an adult. Also the goofy scenes with him doing like the quick draw with the phones. Oh my God, how dated is that? But it's so funny still. Like, and just the usage of that flip phone just feels so classic to me. So I really had a lot of fun rewatching this. What about you, Gemma?
So I wasn't a child when I first saw it. I think I might be the oldest person in the room at the age of 27. So yeah. But even when I first saw it, I was probably not young enough to imagine that it was magical, but I was a massive Robin Williams fan. So I appreciate it for that. And so I came back to Hook for the first time with the kind of Disney history of Peter Pan in mind. So I was really focusing on the mermaids and Tinkerbell. And I did write that in my review that I feel like Hollywood still hasn't worked out what to do with those female characters. And I kind of hope that David Lowery is working on the next Peter Pan. And I'm sort of hoping that maybe he'll nail it. Because it was, what I loved about this is Julia Roberts in this short wig and this kind of boyish Tinkerbell outfit and not at all obsessed with her body. That, you know, moved on from that. That was great. But then still having this moment of only defining herself through her relationship with Peter Pan and having to put the pretty dress on and having to, yeah, have that love story rather than the fact that she's just this incredibly strong fairy who can flip, you know, human-sized people over. And yeah, of course I loved it. I totally enjoyed it. And I think ultimately for me, what works about the film is the arc of Robin Williams's acting in it. How very, very, very staid and sober he is at the start pays off, and how joyful and wonderful he is at the end. Because we all know what he's capable of, and to see half an hour of a movie go by and not get any of that kind of Robin Williams-ness is extraordinary. He really drew that out.
He's so good at that. I mean, the scene where he, like, just, I know it's cliche at this point, but the scene where, you know, the There You Are, Peter scene, you know, the scene where the littlest kid pulling his skin back.
Oh my God. And then that smile. He gets that smile out of him by just, really grabbing his cheeks.
I don't know if people can watch, but yeah, we're all putting our smile.
They're both touching their faces individually, but you probably figured that out by now.
Hand sanitizer. Don't touch
Slim's him. Slim's like closing out the app. Like, what are they doing?
I gotta go.
But by the way, that's like the message of the film. That scene, I think, perfectly encapsulates, like, don't forget, there is that person I lost. We all sometimes feel like, I think we've grown up or we've changed, and you want to find that version of yourself that you once were. And gosh, I mean, that scene always brings me to tears. The blocking, the staging, the music, the eyes. Spielberg, I think, has been quoted saying that to him, it's a movie about close-ups. It's all a film about close-ups. And that perhaps is the thesis of that, is that scene where the kid rediscovers Peter Pan. Like right here.
Aww.
We should fly to the next movie on our list.
Fly or drive? We're going to fly, yes, or we're going to get that yellow station wagon out and take a long drive until When Harry Met Sally Land.
1989, this is a 4.0 average on Letterboxd. And for those of you who aren't aware, I know there are some out there because I was one of them. During their travel to Chicago, from Chicago to New York, Harry and Sally debate whether or not sex ruins a friendship between a man and a woman. 11 years later, they're still no closer to finding the answer. Meg Ryan, Billy Crystal, legendary film. Where were you?
I was watching this one, I believe, also on either Laserdisc or VHS. I'm trying to remember what the format was.
Wow.
And it was, yet again, in the basement on the small TV. And I didn't really know what dating was at this time in my life. I just saw two characters on screen living in the city that I was growing up in, and it felt magical. I can't articulate. I rewatched it in preparation of today. I tried to look at what it is about this film that feels inherently relatable yet magical and mystifying and classic and modern at the same time. And I mean, I'm like, I think it's just the writing and the performances. It's like you really can't beat it in terms of rom-com world. Where were you guys when you first saw it?
I have to be incredibly brave right now and say that this is the first time I've ever seen this movie.
Oh my God.
I finally checked it off my watch list. Gemma commented on my note in her like little doc writing notes. I think she just wrote all in caps, "What?" when I wrote that this is my first viewing.
I think we're both confused.
Yeah. I'm like,
it's one of those movies where you hear about growing up, you see the scene in the diner, you kind of know about this movie, but for whatever reason, it just never was on my, you know, weekend plans for whatever reason.
You think you've seen it when you've seen that scene in the diner, right?
Yeah.
But you haven't until you've actually watched the whole thing. And you're like, you haven't seen the movie if you don't know that Carrie Fisher's in it. You know,
as
the
she's best friend.
Oh my God, she's just perfect as usual.
Yeah, I didn't know the format of the movie. I didn't know that it takes place over the several years. You know, I just thought it was they were together to start, they broke up, they got together. You know, it's totally not the case. It follows their journey, they grow, they change. You know, they have different hairstyles, facial hair. Meg Ryan's hair is unreal in this movie.
Unreal hair.
Unbelievable.
So we need to talk about Nora Ephron, right? So this is directed by Rob Reiner, and here's a Letterboxd fact from Jack, who, by the way, this is our booker, Linda, Jack's wife. This is her favorite movie. It's their New Year's Eve standard movie date. It's their Valentine's Day standard movie date. Directed by Rob Reiner. It's his third highest rated and third most popular film behind Stand By Me and The Princess Bride. So it's right up there.
Wow.
But it's Nora Ephron, right? It's about her. Yeah. You asked me where I was when I first saw it. Maybe the first time I saw it was on television. Probably, which it sort of really was suited to in the late 80s, early 90s, because it's quite episodic. So it's one of those rare films that's okay to break up with an ad break, possibly. But I reckon where I really saw it would have been in the Academy cinema when it was, you know, shown a few years later. Wow. After Sleepless in Seattle had come out and I had been to the cinema probably 20 times to watch that film. I was obsessed.
Sleepless or When Harry Met Sally?
Sleepless.
Sleepless, yeah.
Obsessed, completely obsessed at the time with Sleepless. Thought that's pretty much how my romantic life is going to pan out. And weirdly, 100% met my husband in New York, not at the Empire State Building in Prospect Park. It was a beautiful thing. Anyway, very fateful. So it all panned out. I was right. Nora Ephron wrote my life. But because of her relationship with that film, I went back to see When Harry Met Sally in a cinema, and then it all made sense.
It's a lovely extension. I mean, Sleepless in Seattle, like, I like that movie. I also love that movie. They spend so much time apart and not actually talking to each other that yet still somehow you really feel like they're together. I mean, that movie, it's like a lot of, sometimes I feel like executives in our industry will give the note in a script for a rom-com, like, I want to see your characters in more scenes together. And I always think of Sleepless in Seattle where I'm like, they have like three scenes together and it's at the very end of the movie. But it works. I mean, that's Nora Ephron, master filmmaker. So different story. And Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan.
Yeah. But what I love about the combo of Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron is, you know, she's all about the dialogue and in fact sort of owns herself at one point when the character Jess, who's Harry's best friend, he says the words, "I know dialogue, you know, I'm a writer, I know dialogue." And that is a harsh line. And you're like, that is Nora just celebrating herself on the page. I love that. But you combine that with Rob Reiner, who's very good at doing the kind of shots that she's a more intimate director, but he thinks nothing about just, oh, let's get the chopper out and get the shot of the car driving across the Brooklyn Bridge, arriving in New York. And then we're going to double down at Washington Square Park with a lifting crane shot with sunrise flare coming in as Billy walks away, as Harry walks away from Sally for the first time. So you get a bit of, you know, the grandness with a lot of the intimacy of her dialogue. I love it.
It does feel so inherently cinematic. And I also think Barry Sonnenfeld, the cinematographer of that movie, who would go on to direct Men in Black and, you know, who shot for the Coen brothers for many years, he's bringing a level of let's elevate the rom-com genre. Let's pump the backlight to Testament of Meg Ryan's hair. You used to have these scenes with this amazing glow behind her head. Which, like, unreal glow. And it's magic. It adds to the magic of it. And that's, again, that somehow links back to the Spielberg conversation. But also the outfits in this film. I mean,
oh my
the
God.
Costume designer.
Can we talk about Billy Crystal in denim?
Those tights.
Those tights.
Are you talking about the jogging?
Oh my God, the walking.
The walking.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that walking was trendy as exercise for a while there. Those tights are wild. But no, the jeans, the sweaters. I mean, if we were going to rank the sweaters, have you ever done that as a When Harry Met Sally exercise?
That's a brilliant idea. You know, I haven't, but I did see Letterboxd comment on our movie that said, take a shot for every sweater you see.
So I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, I think that, I think that I will be doing the Harry Met Sally ranking for sure. Have you ever done a sweater ranking?
Not before, but I did last night when I was rewatching it. And I think that Meg's red one is up there. It's number one, closely followed by Billy's. It's the white, the creamy white Aaron knit.
Yeah,
they're sweater, and I think they're in the same scene together.
They're in the same two-shot. Yeah, it's a two-shot. They're looking at the floor. They're like crouched down looking at the floor. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But what I love is that, you know, she's, a lot of movies, people don't wear the same thing twice, but a few of these sweaters come up several years apart, which I really appreciate from a costuming perspective. That's real life.
Good eye.
What struck me after watching When Harry Met Sally, I loved the writing. I watched Dating in New York like right after that. So perfect back-to-back movies. And the struck me was the writing in both movies. So how inspirational to you was that kind of repartee between two potential lovers, two friends? I mean, this movie obviously had to really play into what you wanted to do with your own work.
I think, first of all, honored. That's an insane back-to-back, almost too pressure. I mean, I can only, that's like eating like, you know, because obviously Dating in New York is a celebration of all the rom-coms from the past and some new ones and some old ones. Mm-hmm. When Harry Met Sally, of course, it's shot in New York. It's in the fall. I really love the idea that one of the things that I think Nora Ephron and Rob Reiner would always talk about was like, they wanted to make a movie that wasn't action scenes. It was two people walking around the city, talking about their love life, you know, talking about a city. And this is a Nora Ephron quote, I believe, where she's like, the primary emotion is just unrequited love. And that's how difficult dating in New York can be. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to make a movie that portrayed how complicated dating in the city can be, but also make relatable characters that felt like people we know. It felt like people talk how we talk. And of course, there's added elements of like fairy tale and like all this sort of fun stuff that we do in the film, but at its very core, it was just two people that you feel like you've known or that you want to be friends with or that you've talked to. And that's what Harry Met Sally does so well is like, I mean, Billy Crystal's character is very depressed. I don't think Milo, Jabuki Young White in Dating in New York is depressed. I think Milo is actually a very optimistic character. But that is to say that their conversations about, you know, life, I guess they don't talk about death as much as they do in When Harry Met Sally. Our characters talk about the social norms of Instagram and texting etiquette and their favorite movie, you know, like, but I don't, you know, it was certainly inspirational. I reread that script, Harry Met Sally script, 10, 20 times, you know, just in preparation, just to see how the rhythm of how Nora Ephron and Rob Reiner would, what it looked like on the page versus what it looked like. It sounds cliche, but like watch your favorite movie and look at the script at the same time. And it's film school in a nutshell. It's so fun to do that.
Right.
I'm just thinking about the moment when they're on the plane and he's negging her the whole time, right? He is the Harry, if you want to see what negging actually looks like, it's Harry saying things like, ah, you're actually quite an attractive person. You're actually quite a good looking person. Like a compliment that also casts shades of doubt. And the best comeback to negging ever that I've ever heard is in When Harry Met Sally, when she turns to him on the plane and says,
you look like a normal person, but actually you are the angel of death.
It's just a beautiful, it's a beautiful Unreal. Thing. It's like Unreal. She felt it right away and she calls him. She calls him. Anyway, it comes up in a list, a letterbox list called Men Get Pegged. But also there's a list called The City is a Character, and I was thinking that dating and New York absolutely must be added to that. How did you go about choosing all the spots and the moments and the people and the places and the activities you wanted to, you know, the rooftop bars and the all the beautiful New Yorkiness of it?
It's a fantastic question. I think there's two answers to that. One is the logistics of production, of the idea of making a movie in New York on an indie SAG ultra low budget for, you know, 2 weeks of shooting. And where can I go that I'm going to get multiple locations out of one location? And do I happen to know somebody who works there or owns that place? And the simple construction of like an indie film. But then there comes places that are linked to memories of New York and links to our characters' memories. So Tompkins Square Park, where everyone goes to get broken up with, is like it's like something we invented. You know, it was like I walked that park all the time and I always see people getting into fights and like breaking up. And I'm like, that needs to be a thing. And then in our character's story, that's of course where our character goes and misses the relationship they once had. Bryant Park Grill was one of our producer's friends, you know, knew somebody who worked there. And you look at Washington Square Park, which, I mean, that was probably our most intensive shooting day. And that's a really hard place to shoot a movie because so much is happening. Mm. And you wanted to find places that felt like busy New York, but didn't have giant crowds that are just going to make your life that much more difficult.
Mm. Yeah, there's a certain visual snap to this movie that I find hard to explain. Like When Harry Met Sally is revered for its look and feel of like, I think fall movies that probably appears on every fall Letterbox list. But there was a certain like visual flair when watching this that I was just like, man, I would love to watch this in 4K with like HDR popping all over my TV. But how much of that was your thinking when putting the movie together? You wanted to present a New York that not only follows today's, you know, version of dating, but also just enhances the look and feel of New York itself too.
There, you know, Maria and I, who's my cinematographer, the first references we talked about were the one to Harry Met Sally's and the You've Got Mails. We said, this needs to look like a commercial film. It's funny, by the way, being a filmmaker on Letterboxd is a whole new thing.
Oh,
that
yeah.
I need to like go to therapy. Like I need to like call my friend. I actually called my friend Anish Shiganti. He made a film called Searching.
Oh my God. Okay. Can we just stop there for a moment? Because that's maybe the answer to the question I had. There's an opening montage of a dating app that sort of runs all the way through dating in New York. And I'm watching it. I'm like, this is a cute movie. What the heck is Anish Shiganti doing on this fictional dating app in this movie? So so explain.
He's my best friend from film school. We met on day one at USC in production and we've been there for each other ever since then, which comes with putting each other in each other's movies and helping each other on cuts. And it's kind of that relationship that you always hear about existing, but it's real with him and I. And, you know, him, I called him and I was like, hey, so like when people gave Searching a like half star review, what did that make you feel? And by the way, Searching in my mind is a perfect film. It's a flawless film.
Oh,
it's
my God.
And I'm like, if Searching has half stars, I'm screwed. But he calls me and he said, look, people for like Run would get very personal. Like Shiganti should never make a movie again. And it's like, that's not cool.
God,
like that's, you know,
Run.
People are trying their best to tell stories. But this is all to say that I celebrate all the reviews of our film and I love some of the 5-star ones make me cry. Some of the 3-star ones make me cry. And then some of the 1/2-star ones are still strangely complimentary, but you know, it's just all people can interpret. But to speak to the visual style of the movie, we wanted something commercial. We wanted it to feel magical. We wanted it to be feel like a proscenium, like you're watching a play, you're watching a Broadway musical where the scene where they're kissing in front of the trash can, you know, it looks like a background. It looks sort of like a like something that you would just, you could take the characters out of it and you could still sort of feel like something needs to happen in the space. And that's a big shout out to Maria, who the way she lit them, we shot anamorphic. We have no handheld shots. This thing was all done on sticks to create a storybook feel. And the direction that the characters move, is purposely congruent to their linear progress as a couple, which is like this super strange, like Easter egg where like they move left to right when they're progressing, they move right to left when they're not progressing. And when of course everything ends happily ever after, they, you know, you digitally crane out because we didn't have a real crane, but
stop it.
Yeah. So that's where some of that aesthetic comes from. Also lots of ProMist filter, lots of,
this is what the Letterboxd 1-star reviews are, missing. They need to go back and rewatch it from a technical standpoint.
Exactly.
It's beautiful. So we haven't even really talked deeply about the premise of the film, but in a way, the best way to explain it, I think, and this is from my experience living in New York watching, thankfully I was never fucking single in New York. And there's actually a line in When Harry Met Sally, between, is it Carrie Fisher's character and Jess?
Tell me I'll never have to be out there again.
Yeah.
And I felt that so badly. I think I literally said the same thing to my partner in New York after yet another girlfriend had come over to cry and get drunk and sleep on our couch. Because I think it's like the nature of a really big city that is full of the hottest people in the world. Sort of turns a city into a supermarket where you can window shop forever. Yep. And sort of fail to commit. And so Milo and Wendy in the film, Jabuki Young White and Francesca Real, have basically agreed that this is the state of things in the city. So let's bypass all the dating palaver by coming to an agreement, essentially a kind of short-term romantic contract where we do all the things that a relationship does, but we're not in a relationship.
Here's the broad stock. Basically, we don't get jealous of each other, and for every night that I spend at your place, you spend 2 nights at my place.
How is that fair?
Well, you live with your parents.
I don't live with my parents. I live with my mom and Larry, and they travel a lot, so I'm being financially responsible. I'm not even going to consider signing that until you add cuddling.
Add cuddling?
Yep. And none of that on opposite sides of the bed stuff. I need, boom, 75% of the night together, at least. At least. Separation, that makes me think of divorce. I don't like it.
Most marriages end in divorce anyway.
No deal.
So that's the premise of the film, right? Which, of course, is going to go spectacularly wrong. It's exploring the what it takes to commit, eh? What it takes to kind of finally stop shopping.
It's interesting because they start off with the benefits and lean into friendship. Which Harry Met Sally, they start off as friends and then it becomes more complicated. Mm. In this one, we like to say that they start off with that sort of a potential one night stand and it turns into more of a, how can we turn this into a friendship? Which I think is challenging. But as you said, it's the supermarket. It's the paradox of choice in New York City. It's our generation is so plagued by apps and what if I could be with this other person? And oh, they check off, one thing goes wrong, then I can just go find somebody else.
Speaking of finding love, a young lion.
Really good segue.
Added to the top 10 Gemma segues list on Letterboxd.
Really, speaking of young love, a father-son story of a young prince soon to be king.
1994, 4.2 average. Yeah, I don't even think I need to give the synopsis of The Lion King necessarily, but a lot of people grew up on this movie. A lot of people grew up on that clamshell VHS. What about you? How did you connect with Lion King first?
It was the clamshell VHS. It was the Simba costume. It was the, you know, the Timon and Pumbaa action figures, the little shaving kit you could buy that, as like a 8-year-old where you
the
could
what?
Sort of... Do you remember this? Does anyone here remember? It was a shaving kit. Okay, they used to sell it like toy stores. It was like foam and like a... This is so weird to say that they sold, but they sold it for like children. And you could just... It had Simba on it and it was like... It just is. I can send a link. It exists. It was people listening. If you know what the Lion King shaving kit was, please back me up here. And I
tweet at us to confirm that this is real.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was eventually turned into a passion for Disney films, for animation. I worked briefly at DreamWorks Animation with a lot of people that actually worked on that movie: Chris Sanders, Brenda Chapman. And then, of course, I interned for Hans Zimmer, and I made him coffee.
Excuse me.
Wait, what?
Excuse
How does he take his coffee? How does Hans Zimmer take his coffee?
Okay. That's such a crazy question that you just asked me that, because I think I didn't sign an NDA, but they did swear me to secrecy, but I'm going to tell everybody how he does it. So here we go. I think enough time has passed. Whatever, what's going to happen here? And maybe I didn't actually work for Hans. Who knows? But Hans Zimmer drinks his coffee. Then you pour in the hot coffee, and then you sprinkle some more sugar on that. He takes one of these about every 4 hours. And oh, just also to go on the record, Hans Zimmer is the nicest, best person in the world. And I felt so lucky to be able to make him his coffee, because I would walk in there with the tray, and in there is Jerry Bruckheimer and Rob Marshall, and they're looking at Pirates 4. And I'm like tripping over the wires in his office, which, if you've ever been there, looks like a room out of Pirates of the Caribbean. It's got skulls and technology and all this. It's actually in his master class. You can kind of see the way his office looks.
You're like, don't drop the coffee. Don't drop the coffee.
Oh, I dropped a coffee for sure. I've done it many times. And amazing, amazing job. And I'm very passionate about film scores, and it was a great way to learn about that process.
Wow.
Oh my God.
It was a cold email, by the way. Cold email to his assistant.
Cold email got you?
I had cold emailed his assistant at the time, or his coordinator, and I said I was a USC student who was incredibly passionate about film scoring, and I was a director, and I would just do anything to work for Hans. And I wasn't paid. Like, you know, it was like, I showed up. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely one of the only directors. I think mostly people work there when they want to be in the music world, composers or orchestrators, but very cool scene of people, for sure.
Oh my God, this soundtrack is one of the best soundtracks of all time.
It's the score is incredible. I mean, the music is incredible, but the score itself, you know, the use of theme when Simba is looking into the water and sees Mufasa's reflection, which I think is probably one of the most brilliant scenes in cinematic history, just in terms of the way they used nature and water and the reflective element of James Earl Jones's voice. How often do you guys listen to, like, you know, anything from the Lion King score?
You have a young one in the house, Gemma. Maybe this is an often thing.
I have a young one in the house. So this is another early 90s film that, for whatever reason, I did not see at the cinema in the early 90s when I was at film and television school. Again, for pretty much the same reason as Jurassic Park. Not for me. I was busy, I don't know, trying to watch classics and be intellectual or obsessing over Sleepless in Seattle. And then I had a child, and it's been interesting what's hit with him, and the ones that we rewatch over the last year again and again and again, to the point where I've stopped logging them on Letterboxd, are all of the Cartoon Saloon feature films: Song of the Sea, Wolfwalkers, My Neighbor Totoro, wow, Raya and the Last Dragon, he's become obsessed with, but number one above all is The Lion King.
Wow.
And he will Lion King his way around the house. We sing the songs. He sings I Just Can't Wait to Be King. But more than that, like, this movie has a special place in my heart alongside films like Inside Out. Any film, Totoro is another one where if we're walking through a forest or even past one tree, he'll stop and say, we need to give thanks to the forest spirits. With The Lion King, he never met my father, but he'll often point up at the stars. Oh my God, I'm going to cry. He will often look up at the stars and go, there's Mufasa and there's Papa Wallace. And I'm just like,
wow,
stop, just stop it.
Jeez.
Just like, thank you, movies. Thank you, movies, for giving my child the language to understand the universe around him and the people who brought him into this life.
This, like, is obviously at the top of, like, everyone's list, but for whatever reason, my son didn't fall in love with this movie. So this is the first time I watched it in a very long time. And I'm like, oh, Lion King, yeah, this is on everyone's list. But as I'm sitting down to watch this, like, there's so many banger moments in this movie where it just solidifies it, like, oh yeah, that's why this is on, like, everyone's list ever. And it brought me back to thinking of in theaters, seeing these movies, these Disney movies. And I have this vague memory of seeing, you know, the big previews beforehand. Like, you would see next year's Disney movie, and you'd have to wait a year pretty much to see anything else. It was so different back then. Like, you get, like, this brief trailer of whatever the year after Lion King was. You're like, oh my God, I want to see this movie right now. And you'd have to wait. It just feels so different going back and watching this incredible backgrounds, incredible music. It kind of hits on a time that a lot of people maybe forget about.
Yeah, it was that sort of 90s period. I mean, I think Pocahontas came next, but this was like Little Mermaid was out and they were just kind of, you know, going through the hits, and then this movie dropped. And when I rewatched it, I think it's perfect storytelling, but it's also very fast. It's a short movie.
Yeah, it's 90 minutes.
90 minutes. Right? And it's like, it just hits the story beats. Toy Story 2. I'm saying Toy Story as well. Also Toy Story 2, but Toy Story as well, which came out a couple of years later. Very quick, short movie, but masterful storytelling. And to the Lion King point, that moment you were describing with your son, like that's, I think, what the beauty of that film is it teaches us about family and about the way that we can magic and like the way like our imaginations and memories work and humor, Hakuna Matata, you know, just living life to the fullest. And jam, it's funny.
There's a moment in that film, and it lands on a Letterboxd list called The Good Dad's Cinematic Universe for a really good reason. There is a teachable parenting moment in that movie that I don't think has appeared in any other film, which is the way that Mufasa reacts to the kids going into the elephant graveyard. Is that right?
Yeah.
And the so-called punishment, which really isn't any, it's just a talk.
Simba, I'm very disappointed in you.
I know.
You could have been killed. You deliberately disobeyed me. And what's worse, you put Nala in danger.
I was just trying to be brave like you.
I'm only brave when I have to be. Simba, being brave doesn't mean you go looking for trouble.
But you're not scared of anything.
I was today.
You were?
Yes. I thought I might lose you.
Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful. That is a scene that's worth pulling out and putting into parenting guides for the rest of the time. Can we just we just do need to acknowledge that the casting was pretty insane for Disney, even for Disney, who are, you know, pretty racist at the best of times.
Sure.
This, like, just a bunch of really super white voices and these gorgeous African characters, but we all know that. And
yeah,
John Favreau attempted to correct that in the recent...
Attempted to remedy the situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, the remake, where do you guys stand on the remake?
I have not seen the remake.
It's okay. Fine.
I have not seen it.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. It's interchangeable. Yeah. No, it's not. That's not true. The backgrounds in the first one, I think, Slim, you've noted that as well.
I wanted to point out, you mentioned the graveyard. I mean, the animation in the graveyard and when he returns years later, like that is some all-time animation in those scenes. It's bonkers. Like you don't see that stuff. It's so dark. I love when animation just gets really dark and like almost borderline PG-13, like God forbid. Like the end of The Black Hole is something that jumps to mind when I think of like weird, dark, like PG movies, in my opinion.
Well, the visual, like, you know, in the visual intent of some of the Scar sequences, you know, with his army of hyenas is very directly implying something, you know, in terms they're marching and whatnot. But that's the level. I think they just were like, let's just go in. And I do believe that Lion King was the sort of B movie in terms of like they weren't focused. They were like, this movie's not going to be as big as perhaps Pocahontas. I believe that was what I remember hearing. Wow. Where so they were kind of left to their own devices. They're all trying to prove something. But you look at that team, Andreas Deja, who did the Scar animation, who's like the most famous villain animator of all time, you know.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's so good. I
did have a question about dating in New York in relation to musical animations. And that is, you told one of our writers during Tribeca that another influence on dating in New York was The Emperor's New Groove.
New Groove, yes.
And I'm like, once again, explain yourself, Jonah.
Oh, I'm here for this. I'm going to say some ridiculous things in throughout the career, and I'm here to back them up. I'm curious, have you seen The Emperor's New Groove? Because
mega underrated Disney movie.
Thank you.
Mega underrated.
Thank you.
It's an amazing movie.
It's an amazing movie. And here's the thing about that film that directly influenced our movie. When we were trying to figure out the narrative device that was going to be our narrator and the way that we're playing with storytelling, especially the first 5 minutes of the movie, and like the meta self-referential sense of the movie existing, I watched Emperor's New Groove because he's narrating that entire story, yet he's also living the story. And I think they did an amazing job of that, of Cusco, breaking the fourth wall And that movie is like way better than it needs to be. And so we were watching that and saying, how are they doing it here? And how can we sort of learn from that in terms of how our voiceover is going to work with our story? Because voiceover is really hard to get even remotely close to where it needs to be good. And I think that movie does it perfectly. That was the Emperor's New Groove reference.
Well, you have one more favorite, the very first Pirates of the... I say Caribbean. Do you say Caribbean?
Caribbean? I say Caribbean.
Okay.
Slim, what do you say?
I say Pirates of the Caribbean.
Okay.
I had to say the whole sentence to confirm how I pronounce it.
So we're all on the same page. The Curse of the Black Pearl, 2003, directed by Gore Verbinski. And once again, talking about Disney, this is based on a Disney ride that was then brought to life. And is this the best entrance in a film by a leading character ever?
God. Yes.
Jack Sparrow in the bird's nest of his pirate ship, and then the reverse shot showing that it is very rapidly sinking and it is a mere dinghy.
The subversion of the score as well, this hero's entrance.
Yeah.
And he's sinking, and but he perfectly lands. It's his luck, just his luck, that he perfectly stops right at the dock.
Did you grow up loving Disney, the parks itself, and this ride? What was your connection to the ride itself before the movie? How'd they gel?
So I grew up going to Disney World once in a while, not often, but once in a while. And I loved the ride. I loved Pirates, obviously. We've talked about Hook. And I remember seeing the trailer for this movie, and the trailer for this movie was simply a fake CGI. Music was playing. It was like Johnny Depp, a pirate adventure. And it was just like over the sea, and it was no footage from the movie. I'd never seen a trailer that had footage from the film. And I need to go back and look. They might have not even released anything. And it was just very secret. So then one day, 2003, summer, I get taken to see this movie, and I knew nothing going into it. And then the movie ended, and I went right back outside, got another ticket, went right back in like I would for the ride. And I bought the soundtrack that day. To me, that movie, it beyond the ride itself, it was the swashbuckling adventure film that I think we had long been waiting for since Zorro, came out.
I actually just rewatched Dead Man's Chest for the first time in a long time for my other podcast, plug. But
70 millimeter, right?
Thank you very much. I didn't even have to do it.
Great podcast.
Jonah, officially my new favorite guest on the Letterboxd show.
Get 10% off Squarespace. Use code 70 millimeter.
What are you doing next week, Jonah?
What I said on that podcast was Disney has lightning in a bottle with this movie, with Jack Sparrow, the character. I mean, this could have been so bad, and maybe a movie that had come out recently about a ride and not worked as well. But everything worked in this movie. Gore does amazing work. It looks legit. It looks timeless. The music, rewatching it just feels incredible.
Oh my God, the pirates moving from human to skeleton, back to human, back to skeleton is still flawless 20 years on, nearly 20 years on. This came out, interestingly, the exact same year as Master and Commander. So this was a big year for nautical films. One of my favorite Letterboxd reviews of this from Cowboy is watching this as a kid and seeing Elizabeth save Will's ass every 5 seconds and take zero shit from any men turned me into the hard-headed bitch I am today.
Love that.
And I think, I love that. I think for me, that the presence of Keira Knightley and Zoe Saldana is what has helped these films, because the problematic men in the leading roles, especially in this movie, Jeffrey Rush and Johnny Depp, certainly don't help giving it longevity, but definitely the presence of a decent number, two kick-ass female characters is important.
Elizabeth Swann, incredible character, and ultimately the pirate queen, I believe, Also, Slim, to go back to what you were saying, I actually saw Dead Man's Chest 16 times in theaters.
Holy cow.
I was obsessed with that movie. Arguably, and you look at the movie, the longevity of the film, I've watched countless behind the scenes. I've asked everyone I know about Gore Verbinski. He is apparently he's a very serious filmmaker. I mean, he is if you look at the behind the scenes footage of him working with ILM to make Davy Jones's tentacles look good, this guy is ruthless. I mean, almost to an extent where you're like, I don't know if I could ever really push someone that far, but you look at the effect and it holds up. I also want to say that to speak to the Jungle Cruise of it all, and I'm a big Disney fan, and I feel comfortable enough to say, I love Jungle Cruise. I had a lot of fun there, but it certainly gives you a lot of respect towards Gore Verbinski and, you know, the Mummy and these Indiana Jones of creating spectacle and staged theatrical sequences. You know, having a scene where Jack Sparrow lands perfectly on the dock with the music, like they didn't really do that kind of stuff in Jungle Cruise. Not to say the Jungle Cruise isn't amazing in its own right with The Rock and Emily Blunt having amazing chemistry, but I also have a fun fact about the making of that film and the score of that. Cause you know, Hans Zimmer did not technically get credit for that score. This is probably new information for the internet, but I'll give the quick story. Hans Zimmer was under contract to do another movie called Gladiator. And I think that Jerry Bruckheimer was not 100% on board with the original score they got for Curse the Black Pearl. And to my knowledge, and this actually does not come from the internship, this is just what I've heard throughout the industry and throughout research, that basically Jerry calls Hans and says, Hans, I need your help with the score. Like, I didn't get what I wanted from the original composer. I actually don't know who that ever was. So Hans Zimmer goes away for a weekend, comes up with all the themes for this movie. He says, I can't take credit for this, but I had this wonderful younger composer, Klaus, who's gonna like, who can work with you to do this. And very last minute, they came up with all these amazing themes. And, you know, I almost listen to The Medallion Calls is the name of the score. Like, I listen to that theme almost every single day. You know, it's so fun fact. That's why Hans Zimmer is credited in the second two movies, but not in the first, to my knowledge.
I just got two really quick questions. One is, in your time on Letterboxd, is there a film you've discovered through other Letterboxd members that you have just, that you'd never seen before and that blew you away?
That's a great question. So here's one. It's called, it's called The Watermelon Woman, and Cheryl Dune, I believe it's pronounced.
Yeah. And oh my God, what a great call.
Yeah, a really amazing movie that I would have never heard about. 1996, New York-y kind of, you know, just not even mumblecore vibe, but it's a wonderful film and I wouldn't have never known about it had it not been for Letterboxd.
Excellent video store scenes, Slim. You would love it.
Amazing. Amazing video store scenes.
Yeah. All right, I'm listening.
And final question. You had Letterboxd in an early cut of your film, Dating in New York, which is now in theaters. But some exec gave you a note that it was too niche. When will you release the Letterboxd cut?
The scene. That's like the Snyder cut, right? I don't know if it'll ever get released, but there was a scene where, you know, every character has an introduction in the movie from the narrator where it's like, this is this person. And they met because they were on the subway. There was a scene where it was like, they fell in love over Letterboxd, over their, you know, contradicting opinions of like, the French New Wave and Jean-Luc Godard films. And
oh my God.
Someone was just like, what's Letterboxd? And I'm like, that's your problem.
Thanks so much for listening to The Letterboxd Show, and thanks to our guest this episode, Jonah Feingold, for taking us on a crunchy walk through the falling leaves of rom-coms. Dating in New York is in select theaters and everywhere films are rented digitally in the U.S. from Friday, September 10th through IFC Films.
You can follow Slim, Gemma, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. Thanks to our crew, composing Dynamo's Monica for the theme music, Vampiros Danzotech. Thanks to Jack, as always, for the facts, and our booker, Linda Moulton. Glad we could talk about your favourite movie. And Sophie Shin for the episode transcripts, and to you for listening.
The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production, and if you are enjoying the show and have guest ideas, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Shout out to Elaine Palladino for her Apple Podcast review, and I quote, "Season 2 relaunch is incredible. Slim and Gemma are excellent interviewers, and I find myself hanging on every word," end quote. Can we get that on a t-shirt?
Oh my God.
In the Letterboxd store at some point?
Yeah, 100%. And that's the show. I'm off to sit at my wagon wheel coffee table and drink my coffee with 9 seconds of sugar in it.
couple hours ago, I thought that you were ghosting me. I was ready to cut you out of my life, forget about you, move, honestly. Then you text me out of nowhere, hey, we need to talk. It's very important. All lowercase. You can understand how I'm freaking out, right? I'm like, okay, she's pregnant. She's pregnant. And if you are pregnant, then I'm ready.
We use like so many condoms. I wouldn't be worried.
God, I'm pregnant.
Oh, man, I know. Wouldn't that be terrible?
Woo!
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.